I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and this is Up to Date. It was the year that saw one young girl possessed by a demon and another working as a con artist in the Depression-era Midwest. That year was 1973, and those girls were the focus of the films The Exorcist and Paper Moon. Today, our DVD gurus are here to discuss those and other notable movies from the year that saw Bruce Lee's final film, Yul Brynner as a rogue robot gunslinger, and the classic private eye Philip Marlowe on screen again. We'll get you up to date after this hour's news. Welcome to Up to Date. I'm Steve Kraske. What binds the very well-known films Paper Moon, The Exorcist, and Serpico together? Well, they were all made in 1973. Today, for a reason we're about to find out, the DVD gurus will talk about a series of movies from the utterly unremarkable, seemingly unremarkable year of 1973. The gurus are Mitch Bryan, who's a screenwriter, UMKC film prof, and writer for 435 South. Welcome back, Mitch.
It's great to be here.
And film critic Jason Heck is also in the house. How are you, buddy?
Hey, pretty lady. How are you?
Yeah, nice to see you. So why 19... And that was the music from Enter the Dragon, right?
That's correct.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
Well, why 1973?
Because on July 4th of this year, I turned 40 years old.
No kidding. Happy birthday.
Thank you. It's great.
I'm July 4th?
July 4th, yeah. Well, I was born in Germany, so it really didn't matter much at the time. But yeah, I have officially placed one foot in the grave. So I'm just like Joan Rivers now, like one foot in the grave. And Mitch had a great idea. He said, it's your birthday. Let's do a birthday show. And how about movies from the year you were born? And the more we looked, the happier we got. There are some amazing movies from the year I was born.
It was hard to pick because we had done so many movies from 1973 over the past, 7 years of doing the show It's a good year for movies. It really was.
If our listeners have any thoughts on their favorite movies from 1973, get out your smartphones and start clicking on, trying to figure out what films were made that year. Give us a call, 816-235-2888, and our email address, uptodate@kcur.org. You can also tweet us at @KCURUpToDate. So what you're saying is you aren't eligible to ever become president of the United States.
Yeah, there's that. Unless they pass the Schwarzenegger law, I'm SOL on being president. So sorry, America. I've got some pretty big ideas too. Got some big ideas.
You could have done so much for us.
An airplane in every garage. That was like my first idea. It's not going to happen.
Okay, so 73, a good year for films. Because why, Mitch? What was happening out there?
It was one of the great transitional years. I think there were three movies that came out in 73 that would top the $100 million mark. And that was one of the big signals to Hollywood that there was real money to be made in this business. And we've gotten to that point now where even then, though, and for years to follow, you'd make a movie for $5 million or $10 million, and if it doubled its investment, you'd be happy. Of course, now it costs $30 million just to publicize and release a movie, and the distributors take half, exhibitors take half. And so you got to make $60 million plus whatever the movie cost to break even. So the business has changed, but it has changed because these companies were able to see that you could make hundreds of millions of dollars. And as I said, there were three pictures in 73 that broke that mark, The Exorcist, American Graffiti, and The Sting, all made over $100 million.
And in those days, again, that was real serious money.
Inflation is $1 then is $5.25 now. So do the math and you realize that The Exorcist is making close to $1 billion.
Wow. And what a movie that was.
By those figures, The Devil and Miss Jones, which was an X-rated – it was a porno film, in adjusted dollars, would have made about $100 million.
Yeah. The 11th highest grossing movie in 1973 was a rated X porn movie. That's amazing. Huh.
I remember my parents wouldn't let me go see The Exorcist, and everybody was talking about it. So finally, we got a whole car full of my buddies. We went to the drive-in and saw it there. And I sort of remember I was so sort of excited slash nervous to see it, like, could I handle this film or not? But what I remember about it is sort of sitting in the back seat of that car, sort of chuckling because we were all laughing nervously to sort of get through it. And I remember it didn't hit me nearly as hard. And I remember thinking it was a little more absurd than it was scary.
That's because you're with all your buddies.
Well, that's right.
And you've got the courage of that group.
Yeah,
you've
yes.
got, you know, it's and
no
what
question.
What are we doing? We're scared of something. We mock it.
Yeah.
You know, to make ourselves feel better. My mom confessed freely that when she saw The Exorcist when she was pregnant with me, she was afraid she'd miscarry. She said, I very nearly
really?
Miscarried. I was so terrified in that film. And, you know, my mom was, you know, country club district, Episcopal, so, you know, kind of upbringing. She went to some good Ivy League schools to kind of got her brain opened up. But deep down inside, that you know, there's a core that movie touched. And obviously with all the money it made. But it's easy for us to go to movies as in a group of in a pack for safety and
yeah.
kind of giggle. I remember when I saw I was 10 years old and I went over to a buddy's house and watched Halloween 2 for the first time. And my buddy, you know, went to bed and his mom got home from being out late and I was still up at 1 a.m. and had to talk to her for half an hour before I felt brave enough to actually crawl into a sleeping bag and go to sleep.
Mm-hmm.
Horror movies alone are quite a different proposition from horror movies with a group of macho buddies.
But it was one of the first horror films that was an endurance test when you saw it in the theater. Can
mm-hmm.
you take it?
Mm-hmm.
And I think I had mm-hmm. the same experience when I finally saw it on home video with three or four friends. It didn't have the same impact.
Yeah.
It was still scary, and
yeah.
we were laughing because we were scared, and it's
yeah.
a way to release the tension. And
right.
people were actually laughing in the theaters, too. The audiences who saw that film were – many of them were really vocal. Others, people were getting up and walking out, and they said that after the initial shows of it, there were lines not only around the block to get in, but there were lines of people who had just seen the movie who didn't want to get in their cars and who were standing around talking about it. And one of the people at the studio said, well, this is your movie. This is
yeah.
this is the movie where people are going to talk afterwards and people are going to get up and leave the theater and people are going to throw up. And this
yeah.
is all what the movie is, so you better capitalize on it.
Well, let's do this. We'll get to The Exorcist towards the end of our show today. So if folks want to share their memories of seeing that film back in 1973, call us later on this hour about The Exorcist. Well, Mitch, you were saying this was 73 was a transitional year. In what sense? What was happening that year that made it as important as it was?
Well, that was the year of the American Indian Movement occupying Wounded Knee.
Mm-hmm.
That was the year where offensive action in Vietnam was suspended.
Nixon is president. He's Nixon's a year
president.
Away from resigning the office.
That's yeah. right. Agnew will resign that year as vice president, and Gerald Ford will then take over.
That's right.
He was Speaker of the House. So it was a year of political turmoil. It was the end of the 60s, you know, the beginning of the turbulent 70s, the disillusionment with the government, the sense of the government being corrupt, not being there to serve you but serve itself.
A new idea, really, to a lot of Americans.
It really was.
At that time.
It was
yeah.
radical. It was this notion of not being able to trust the structures that we had put into place, that they had gotten out of control. Trickles into a lot of the movies that came out that year. You had some pure escapism on one hand, like American Graffiti, which was look back to the wonderful 1962, where were you in 62, nostalgia. There was a big nostalgia craze that was sweeping the country with old rock and roll music. And then countered against that were these films, that many of which we're going to talk about today, that suggested that things were not working correctly.
Mm-hmm. Of the films made in 73, the year of your birth, Jason, mm-hmm. is there one or two that ranks that on the top of your all-time favorite film list?
We're going to talk about them. In fact, my first movie is going to be that, and honestly, The Exorcist. It's funny,
one of your favorite films, The Exorcist?
I think The Exorcist is extraordinary. In
really?
Every single way, in writing, in filming, in performances, in music, it is just – there is no bigger grand slam for me in horror than
one of the 10 great American films.
Oh, yeah.
Is that right?
Without a doubt.
Truly remarkable. And Mitchell will tell us all about what an arduous process it was to get it done. But I think The Exorcist is a very nearly perfect horror film. And it's funny, they re-released it in 2000, and, you know, audiences were just cracking up and laughing because so much stuff that that movie gave us has been so parodied and overdone. And now we're, you know, in this era of what's called torture porn, where, you know, hyper-violent horror and gore for its own sake and horror through shock, as opposed to horror through horrifying ideas and horrifying concepts, which The Exorcist epitomizes better than almost anything.
I had no idea The Exorcist ranked that highly on critics' film lists, all-time great American films. That's news to me.
Yeah, it's extraordinary.
Yeah. Okay. Well, let's go to our list. Jason, you want to start off with the song, the theme music that opened our show today, Enter the Dragon. It's a Bruce Lee film where his character is recruited by British intelligence to investigate a martial arts tournament believed to be masking an opium ring.
You bet. And a couple of things about Enter the Dragon. One, it brought martial arts to America. There is no possible equivocation on that. It was Warner Brothers co-financed it with Golden Harvest in Hong Kong. Martial arts had been very much a fringe thing. They had been, you know, there had been some sense of empowerment. It had been part of the Black Power movement, learning martial arts. But it had been very much confined to Hong Kong. And a few, you know, New Line Cinema, which before it became big, was actually just sort of a cut-rate distributor, would bring these movies over from Hong Kong, dub them. And, you know, drive-ins needed something to play while kids were making out. And that's what these movies were. Enter the Dragon, it doesn't have a huge budget. It doesn't have huge stars. It is conceptually a pretty simple film. It is low rent James Bond. It is an agent infiltrating an impregnable. You know, we have the impregnable fortress impregnated concept. Yeah. We have a guy who is going in undercover, and it's interesting. Lee was kind of an unknown quantity to American audiences, so Warner Brothers hedged and they put two American actors in. We have John Saxon, who is a pretty good actor. He's good looking, he's charismatic, he just never really made the transition, and he's a good actor who's pretty good, who's okay at martial arts. Then we have a great martial artist who's an okay actor, and this is Jim Kelly, who is arguably one of my top three actors. I love Jim Kelly. I love him. He is this amazing, charismatic. He can't necessarily...
We didn't hear that much about him over the years.
We didn't, because he had a very short career. He plays a guy named Williams, who is a sort of martial arts teacher, kind of activist on the run. He has an encounter with some racist LA cops. He beats him up with some karate, which is a hugely empowering thing for black audiences to see in 1973. And he flees to the tournament. It's the only place he can go. He's got to get out of the country, and he's going to go test his mettle. John Saxon plays a sort of down-on-his-luck gambler playboy who happens to be a something-level black belt and is able to beat up the mob when he has to. But he's in the tournament as well because he needs the money. And, of course, Bruce Lee is in the tournament. He's a former Shaolin monk. And Mr. Han, who is putting on the tournament, is a fallen Shaolin monk. So we've got some family honor at stake. We've got the honor of his religious sect at stake. And what we get is a movie that is radically changed by Bruce Lee during filming. He rewrites huge scenes. He choreographs all the fights. He decides to put Chinese culture on display. He said, you know, this is very much a by-the-numbers action picture, and I want to – so he writes all the Shaolin stuff into it, and he really takes control of this as his vehicle. And guess what? Martial arts become a mammoth worldwide sensation. The movie costs,
and this film's a big hit.
The movie costs $850,000. It makes $90 million worldwide. It is gigantic. It is a huge hit in countries that have never had huge hit. India, where no movie that wasn't in Hindi had ever been a hit. This was the number one movie of the year. It changes everything. And so we get this stream of martial arts films that start happening. And of course, Bruce Lee dies at the age of 32, 6 days before this film is released. And thus...
How did he die?
Depending on who you ask, I believe it was a sort of reaction to a prescription painkiller or aspirin.
It was a brain aneurysm.
But I thought it had something to do with painkiller that he was given. But in any case, it is a very mysterious death. I mean, this man who epitomizes health, who embodies, you know.
Was it a result of his fighting?
It had almost nothing to do with that. I mean, this is a guy who was a fanatic, a true fanatic about his health. You know, the guy would do 5,000 crunches when he woke up, and who was absurdly fast. He lived his martial art as this sort of lifestyle. He wrote a book called The Tao of Jeet Kune Do, which was the style of martial arts. He was incredibly hip. He taught people like Steve McQueen and James Coburn at his studio, and everybody kind of got onto this bandwagon, and then Enter the Dragon kicks it into the mainstream, kicks it into mainstream cinema. And on the box office chart, I think it comes in at number 13 for the year, which for a movie that costs $850,000 is insane.
Insane.
And then kick it into the stratosphere in terms of legend because Bruce Lee dies mysteriously.
How many films did he wind up making altogether?
Well, this was his big American effort. He did a bunch in Hong Kong, Big Boss, Chinese Connection, Fists of Fury.
And those all became, we all saw those as kids.
Yeah, they were all released over here after Enter the Dragon.
Okay.
Kind of. Then they got a reappraisal, and the dubbing was polished up a little bit and stuff like that.
And he had done some American television. He'd been in the Green Hornet series that was short-lived,
and then
he had a little recurring role in Longstreet as Longstreet's martial arts trainer.
He was Kato in the Green Hornet, but also Enter the Dragon launched the career of Jim Kelly, who was a guy who straddled martial arts and blaxploitation movies. But this is the time when producers were realizing that, hey, that black people go see movies too. So they started targeting movies directly at them. And Jim Kelly embodied great charisma, incredible physical fitness, and the empowerment of a black man who was a superb martial artist, which was completely brand new for black audiences. And he used this to launch into a really great career. He just died a couple weeks ago at the age of 65.
Really?
So, he
dies young, too.
He died, Well, 65, he had this great career after he gave up Hollywood. He used his money and opened up a tennis school in San Diego, and he was an incredibly gifted tennis player. And he totally turned his back on Hollywood. There was no Tarantino-type revisiting of his career. No, I'm going to get you, sucker. He was fine. And he started showing up at autograph conventions in 2010, and people said, my God, you're still alive? But I went down to Austin, Texas, and met him at the Alamo Drafthouse Cinema when they showed Enter the Dragon and Black Belt Jones.
How was he?
He was great. He called me brother. And it was honestly arguably the greatest moment of my life.
Yeah.
I said, I discovered your movies when I was a sophomore in high school, and I think you're amazing. And you had an incredibly great career, and he signed my picture of him and a copy of Fighting Stars magazine, and I got that stuff in a frame. Absolutely, I got it in a frame.
What's the clip you have here Enter the Dragon?
This is a Jim Kelly clip. I decided not to do Bruce Lee, but to honor the man who just died. This is Williams, who is being questioned by Mr. Han, the inscrutable, deadly owner of the island in the tournament, about having crept out of his palace the previous night, and there's going to be a little bit of a fight as he tries to have his men take Williams down.
We are all ready to win, just as we are born knowing only life. It is defeat that you must learn to prepare for.
I don't waste my time with it. When it comes, I won't even notice.
Oh, how so?
I'll be too busy looking good.
What were you looking for when you attacked my guards?
Wasn't me.
You were the only man outside the palace.
I was outside, but I wasn't the only one.
You will tell me who else.
Mr. Han, suddenly I like to leave your island.
It is not possible.
Bull, Mr. Handman. Man, you come right out of a comic book.
Now you've reminded me just why he was such a great actor.
I hope that I've explained in his five-fingered way exactly why he was great. No, he was poetry in motion to watch. He was terrific, and he just managed to pull off enough attitude that the acting didn't matter that much.
We're talking about the films of 1973 in honor of Jason Hecht's 40th birthday. Vicky emails us and writes, "Wow, I thought 73 wasn't so good, but look at the list. I looked at the list and realized I loved all of these movies: American Graffiti, Paper Moon, The Sting, The Way We Were, Serpico, Sleeper, A Touch of Class, The Day of the Jackal, The Paper Chase," which I saw over and over again at Wisconsin as an undergrad before every set of final exams. You'd go there to see that film to get all psyched up about Harvard Law School and the pressures of taking those exams there. Let's go to some phone calls. If you have a favorite film from 73, 816-235-2888, and our email address update@kcur.org. Let's go to Tyler from Kansas City, Missouri. Good morning.
Hi, Hi, thank you for having me.
Sure.
You actually just mentioned a film that I thought was not going to be on the list, but The Way We Were. And, you know, this was such a time of political tumult, and even from what I listened to earlier, this idea of the African-American and the Asian influence. And
yeah.
Then in this film, you have the Caucasian All-American boy and the Jewish girl. And there's this kind of idea in the film of memory versus modern life. You know, do we live in the past? Do we go to the future? And James Woods was in it, did such a good job. I know that Barbara Streisand and Robert Redford did not rehearse, from what I understand, until that very first day. But the fairy tale and yet the political consequences and then the divorce at the end, and that you know, Hubble does not see his daughter ever again, but that gentle sweep of the hair. And that changed so many. My mother is a teacher of feminist politics, and changed so many feminists. It was an interesting sort of rollover into romance. How does feminism approach romance, in a sense? And the daughters from that generation, I'm 43, it was like a rite of passage to see The Way We Were. And it touched a lot of women. And I don't know, I'm curious to know if it touched men in that same way, or if there was a feel of that, because it's deeply rooted in who I am and what I do, as well as with many of the women of my generation.
Right.
Some are mothers. I mean, I just wanted to know if you could comment and you know, the fairy tale versus the political critique of the time.
Yeah, Tyler, thank you. And The Way We Were is not on the list today, but.
But it's on our romance. We did a romance show, you know, and you can listen to us talk about that if you just go to the archive and look for the Love Story show. But yeah, definitely that film. You know, it was her story. She's the main character, and it's really from her point of view more than from his. And it's another great example of how the 1970s was the decade where we revisited filmmakers. A new generation of filmmakers would revisit these familiar genres and modernize them and do things that they couldn't do back before the production code was in place, and be far more challenging. Like, we're going to make a love story where they get divorced at the end.
Yeah.
It's like, really? That's the kind of love story you're going to do, huh? Well, it's the 70s.
Yeah.
We're going to take a completely different approach to it and really challenge the audience. And the audiences of the 1970s wanted to be challenged. You know, that what you went to the cinema, yes, for escapism and entertainment, but you also went to see something different, to be really challenged. And that's definitely not where we are today.
Hard to believe that film came out 40 years ago this year. Okay, let's continue on our list of films from 1973. Mitch Bryan, let's turn to one of my favorite films, Serpico.
Serpico, which is based on the true story of a New York cop who came up against the corruption within the department and started pushing back. And in doing so, you know, was nearly murdered by an act of omission by fellow police officers. Again, we're at this place in American history where we don't trust our institutions anymore. In fact, where the institutions are not only corrupt but ultimately malevolent. And you've got Al Pacino in a terrific role as this chameleon of a character, always in disguises.
Hasidic Jew
in one scene and a meat packer in another. And this extraordinary sense of immediacy in the way that Sidney Lumet directed this picture, which was set in New York, and it's very much what would become called the New York style, which was a sort of documentary style. But that's not to say that the camera was handheld all the way through, but a sort of stark approach to the lighting, a sense that you're seeing all the grit and dirt on the streets of New York. And the characters, as so many 1970s films, the characters all look like somebody who could live next door to you. This isn't glamorous, beautiful movie stars anymore. These are guys like De Niro and Pacino and Dustin Hoffman, who were not classically handsome, Cary Grant kind of movie stars.
Yeah.
But the film is wonderful and yet extraordinarily frustrating as you go with him on his journey. And every time you think he's gonna, you know, knock in a door and change things, he just gets bumped up to a higher level where it's even more corrupt. And mm-hmm. so this sense of the frustration, like Sisyphus trying to roll that boulder up the hill, is what fuels Serpico. And there might be people who would say, I don't want to see that movie. That's not entertainment to me, watching this guy just not managing to succeed. But it is in some ways the ultimate underdog story with a certain kind of quiet triumph in the end. But, you know, it's back when Pacino was known for how he withheld his emotions.
Was this his first big film?
No, he'd done The Godfather.
Oh, that's right, of course.
And when was Dog Day Afternoon?
Yeah. And Dog Day Afternoon was right afterwards. So it was that sort of sweet spot where he really defined himself as this quiet, understated, you know, about to explode but seldom explodes kind of actor. Whereas now, you know, he does take out.
He's always about ready to pop.
It's about withholding.
Just go off. Yeah. What's the clip we have here from Serpico?
So this is a speech that Frank Serpico makes about why he wants to be a cop.
All my life I wanted to be a cop. Sick, I can remember nothing else. I remember this one time. There was something happened, a domestic argument or something. Somebody stabbed somebody. And there was this crowd around this tenement. I must have been 9, 10 years old. I was this big. I went over to see what was going on. There was the red light going around and around. All these people, and I couldn't see. And I kept saying, well, do you know what's going on? Do you know? Nobody knew. It was like the big mystery behind that crowd there. All of a sudden, the crowd just parted. Like the Red Sea, you see. And there were these guys in blue, and I said, they know.
That's a great
nice speech, yeah?
What a great speech. Yeah, yeah. That's Mitch Bryan's first pick as we survey the films of 1973. Serpico. Peter writes us this: The Friends of Eddie Coyle was made in 1973, and I think it's a great example of American film noir. I also think it was Robert Mitchum's final movie. Make sense?
I don't know if it was his final movie. Could have been, but I'm not sure. But a terrific picture.
Okay.
Terrific movie.
Well, let's take a break. When we come back, we'll continue our survey of the films of 1973 with Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck. We'll get to The Long Goodbye, Paper Moon, Westworld, and, of course, The Exorcist. And this movie, this is what? What's this music?
My name is Nobody.
Yeah, My Name is Nobody. That's right. Okay. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you're listening to Up to Date on KCUR. Surveying the films of 1973 with our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan, Jason Heck. Jason Heck, tell us about The Long Goodbye. It's about a chain-smoking, wisecracking private eye named Philip Marlowe, who drives a buddy from L.A. to the Tijuana border and is subsequently accused of helping his friend flee after murdering his friend's wife.
Yeah, well, yeah, you done my job for me.
Well, there you go. Next movie.
Thanks for tuning in. No, that is very that's it on the surface, but the movie is this movie is all about services and what lies beneath them. We have Philip Marlowe, you know, the quintessential private eye, the knight of the streets. He cracks wise and he knows good and evil when he sees it. Except in this movie, we find out that he's not quite as astute as we might have remembered from The Big Sleep, when he was, of course, played by Bogart, who shot and punched and kissed his way through broads and thugs, and he was a flawed man, but here he is flawed, he is wilted, he is crumpled, he is a man out of his time, and that is very much what this movie has to talk about in terms of taking that 50s private eye and putting him in 1973, a much more challenging era than the 50s. So we've got Elliot Gould as a very down on his luck, very seedy private eye named Philip Marlowe. He chain smokes. Interestingly enough, he's the only person in the movie who smokes. Altman sort of wanted to show against health-conscious California this guy who was out of his time. He drives a 48 Lincoln Continental Cabriolet. He does, you know, there are all sorts of things that don't fit of this time, a time of rampant cynicism, of everybody lying, of dirty, not necessarily really corrupt cops, but cops who just don't really care. You know, it doesn't take much to, you guys got no reason to take me in? Well, one cop shoves him against another one and says, oh, that's assault, and in he goes. So, you know, Altman didn't necessarily want to do this movie. The original casting choices had been Lee Marvin and Robert Mitchum for Marlowe. And then basically he was bribed into doing it by being told he could use Elliot Gould. Gould was persona non grata for a couple years. He had not worked. He'd been...
Why?
He'd had major difficulties on the set of... where was it? A Glimpse of the Tiger, where he had constantly bickered with Kim Darby and Anthony Harvey. And
I need to have some major difficulties on this set sometimes.
Well, folks, when the mics aren't on, let me tell you.
Yeah,
we do.
It's ugly.
Believe you me.
Really ugly.
His handlers, he's burned through a few of them. But he had to undergo not only your standard physical to get insured on this movie, he had to also undergo a mental evaluation by a psychiatrist.
Oh,
and that's what the studio said. And Altman said, I'll do this if I can have Gould and if the ending is not changed. Another fascinating thing in how it was written, Lee Brackett, who is a screenwriter who wrote The Big Sleep in 1946 for Howard Hawks, wrote this, and she took Chandler's novel, which was in, you know, we go back and we read Raymond Chandler now, Trouble Is My Business and things like that, and it's great because it's of its time. Well, you had two options on this one. You could either do a period piece or you could turn it on its head, and Altman decided to turn it on its head. So we have you know, there's no gunplay in the movie. Our principal heavy is a guy a fitness crazy thug named Marty Augustine, who's not even a thug. He's a crime boss and a loan shark, and he is played by a director named Mark Rydell, who directed The Cowboys and On Golden Pond. So he plays this, I mean, who is capable of shocking violence, who is terribly funny, and who does not seem at all like a crime boss, but it's a crime boss in, you know, salad mad and fitness mad California circa 1973. And so
how happy are you with Elliot Gould in this role?
I like him a lot. He's what he needs to be. The movie is, it doesn't, it's tough to get behind Marlowe. There aren't a lot of triumphs here. You know, he cracks wise, but there is this great apathy that has hold of him. His big line is, it's okay by me. He says that 10 or 15 times throughout the movie. You know, he lives across this sort of hallway in his apartment from an apartment where 6 to 12 women are sort of these hippy dippy free loving women are cavorting and doing gymnastics naked at 3 a.m. and he just says, it's okay by me. Going to the grocery store, can I buy you girls some brownie mix? You know, there is nothing for him to care about except in the end his own code. That's all he has. And the code is so twisted and beaten up by the things he comes up against throughout the picture that at the end, when he does act on it, it's kind of a shock. You don't see it coming when he has this, that you realize that that's it. And he's very and for the first time in the picture, he actually seems happy at the end of the movie that some kind of decision has been reached, some kind of move. And it's great. The principal thing in the movie is he's sent to find this author played by Sterling Hayden, who has a very Hemingway-esque lifestyle that's kind of destroying him, and he's debauched and past his prime, and Marlowe is brought in by his very gorgeous, very waspy trophy bride to find him after he heads off on a bender for a week and can't be found.
What's the clip here from The Long Goodbye?
That's what we're dealing with here. We have Marlowe meeting Eileen Wade, this beautiful woman who lives at the Malibu Colony, and being given his marching orders to go and find her husband.
You're Philip Marlowe. You don't look like your picture.
Thank you very much.
I'm Eileen Wade.
And you don't look like a secretary. And if Mr. Wade is up in his library working, I don't think you need me.
My husband is not upstairs in the study. When he disappears like this, I try to cover up for him. Protecting his image, I suppose you'd call it.
Oh, he's done this sort of thing before?
Oh, yes. My husband has a drinking problem. Every so often, he reaches a stage when he feels that he needs professional help.
So he goes someplace to dry out. Is there some particular place he likes to go to?
Yes, but it's not there. I've checked every single place I could think of.
Didn't he tell you where he was going?
No, we're usually not speaking when he leaves.
How long's he been gone?
Almost a week.
A week? Weren't you worried? I mean, waiting a week before you call somebody to find your husband.
What are you implying, Mr. Marlowe?
Well, I don't mean to be tactless, Mrs. Wade, but it doesn't look like you walked into a door.
No. As a matter of fact, I didn't. I fell out of bed.
That's from the film The Long Goodbye, Jason Hecht's pick, as we survey the films of 1973 in honor of Jason's 40th birthday.
Feels
40
great.
Years
feels
ago.
Great.
It feels send, great. Yeah,
send,
whatever it
send
does.
Send cakes courtesy of KCUR.
There you go.
I like cupcakes.
Yeah. Mitch Bryan, let's move on to Paper Moon, tells the story of Moses Prey. Haven't heard these names in a long time. And Eddie Loggins in the Depression-era Midwest. The two form an unlikely duo of con artists, and they travel from town to town selling recently widowed women unordered Bibles at very high prices.
That's exactly right. Well done. you know, the picture was shot in Hays, Kansas, in St. Joseph, Missouri.
Ah, that's right.
So there are probably people listening right now who might have had something to do
remember those
with
times.
That picture. Peter Bogdanovich had recently finished. He just come off What's Up, Doc, which was a big hit, with Ryan O'Neal and Barbara Streisand. Prior to that, he had done The Last Picture Show. And so he was riding high and was hired to do this. He had been preparing, actually, a big Western that was going to have John Wayne and Jimmy Stewart and reunite all these guys. And then that picture fell through, and he was offered to direct this.
And such a soft-spoken guy.
Yeah, but a real aficionado of cinema. Mm-hmm. And like all of his other movies and like so many of the movies of 1973, this is a movie that's definitely haunted by the ghosts of Hollywood. He made some choices, for example, to shoot the picture in black and white, by the fact that it's set in the 30s, to embrace those great road movies like It Happened One Night and some of those films. And he made this really wonderful piece of Americana. And apparently the novel was set in the South, but he decided as they were scouting locations that maybe it would be interesting to move it into the Midwest. And so they went out into Western Kansas and with that black and white cinematography created this really amazing, stark, beautiful landscape. Mm. And of course, the chemistry of casting father and daughter together in the movie is really what makes the film happen. I mean, it's where the magic comes. And Tatum O'Neal at age 9 would win the Academy Award for Best Supporting Actor in this film. And it's, having revisited it, it's absolutely as fresh and wonderful now as it was when it was made. It's a tricky film structurally in that it has a couple of incidents that really fuel the middle of the picture and the third act of the movie that are unexpected. It's kind of episodic, but it doesn't matter because the characters are so interesting and you're so, you know, in love with them and on this journey with them, and you mm-hmm. so want to see father and daughter ultimately, you know, reconcile as opposed to fight the whole time. And they do help each other out. She becomes quite a fine little con man in her own, in her own right. So it's really charming picture, and it's beautifully made. Every shot you could freeze frame it and look at it, put it up on your wall. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's so beautifully photographed by Laszlo Kovacs.
What's the clip we have here from Paper Moon?
This is one of the early getting to know you scenes, or it's a big argument that's happening because Moses is about to try to take – he's going to put her on the train and send her off to her aunt in St. Joe. She doesn't want to go, and she's found out that he actually has been paid $200 to accomplish this task, and she wants that money if she's going to have to go.
You know what the trouble is with you? You've got no appreciation. All right. Maybe I did get a little money from that man, and you're entitled to that. But I'm entitled to my share for getting it for you, ain't I? Now, where do you think you'd be without me? You think them folks would spend a penny to send you east? No, sir. But who got you a ticket to St. Joe? Who got you a knee-high in a Coney Island? And threw in $20 extra, not to mention 85 cents for that telegram. You wouldn't have had any of that without me. I took you, didn't I? All right, I think that's fair enough. We're both a little better off. We'll get to St. Joe. I get myself a little better car. Fair is fair. Now, drink your knee high and eat your Coney Island.
I want my $200.
I don't have your $200 no more, and you know it.
If you don't give me my $200, I'm going to tell a policeman how you got it, and he'll make you give it to me because it's mine.
But I don't.
Man, she sounds young.
Yes. Wow. She's really funny in the show. Check it out.
It's such a great movie.
Very good.
That's Paper Moon. We're talking the films of 73, The Sting, The Way We Were, Serpico, Sleeper, all those films made that year. Jason Heck, let's move on to Westworld. An amusement park lets customers live out their fantasies using robots. Imagine that.
And in fact, if Westworld was real, I would have dinner with the Steve Kraske robot every night. It would be so great.
Thank you.
And I would win every argument. And you would shut up when I told you to. Westworld is fascinating. It is a movie that cost nothing to make. It was totally shot essentially on the old MGM backlot properties from all of their period movies. It cost bupkis. It had some major stars of the time, but nothing that's going to break your bank. Written and directed by Michael Crichton, whose star was on The Ascension. He had given us the Andromeda Strain. And Crichton really rose to prominence in this era right after 2001, where science fiction was very obsessed with us losing our humanity because of technology, mm-hmm. with technology overwhelming us and eventually destroying us. Crichton had made a great career with that. If you look at his books, they are about complex systems with one thing screwing up. And in Westworld, you have robots that kind of get this sort of virus. In Jurassic Park, it's the greed of one man who turns off the fences and everything goes bazooey. And he made a very good career doing this. Westworld also, he had gotten enough clout that he was able to direct the film as well. And he proved himself an okay director. He directed a few more films, but his pessimism didn't really work out so well after Star Wars and Close Encounters had kind of taken sci-fi or science fantasy, as Star Wars was, but kind of moved it into this realm of childlike innocence. And it was a place for us to escape, as opposed to something that would relentlessly, remorselessly crush us down into sort of little cubes. And so he did Looker, he did Runaway. These didn't get a lot of success. People weren't really interested in seeing how technology would ruin their lives. And so he was forced to write books for a living. Spielberg bought one called Jurassic Park, and hey, presto, we enter Michael Crichton, bazillionaire. Mm-hmm. But this is well before that, and he turns out he's kind of a witty director. We have James Brolin and Richard Benjamin as two buddies who are going to Delos, which is a theme park composed of three worlds, medieval world, Roman world, and West world. And West world is where you can be violent. Roman world's where you can, it is referred to as a lusty treat for the senses and morally decadent. So you see sort of as they're on this hovercraft that's carrying them, we have a husband who is smiling because he's going to medieval world and we'll get to joust. And we have his wife smirking as she's going to Roman world and will obviously be having sex with any number of gladiator robots and all these other things. It's an amazing concept. Let's go to a place where we can kill, where we can shoot, where we can have sex without – it's impunity. In fact, you hear these mechanical voices saying you are here to indulge your every whim. Nothing can go wrong. Well, it turns out that something does go wrong. The robots discover some – well, they keep having what a guy calls it – it's like an infectious disease. They keep sort of having these breakdowns until finally they don't just break down. They all go homicidal and they begin slaughtering the guests. Our two heroes who have shot and sexed and drunk their way through Westworld have a nemesis in the form of Yul Brynner, who is the robot gunslinger. And his job as a robot is generally to provoke guests. And he picks fights and he's churlish and surly until they gun him down. He sets them up and they have to duel if they want to do their thing. And he's designed to draw slower and get killed, except when he starts drawing faster and blowing guests away. The performances are great, but conceptually it's really interesting. And Crichton does a few things to turn the thing on its head. A, he's casting Yul Brynner, who looks exactly like he did in The Magnificent Seven as Chris from The Magnificent mm-hmm. Seven. So what he's telling us is this isn't the real West. This is the Hollywood West. Mm-hmm. This is, I'm gonna have a little fun here. We also get these great behind-the-scenes images of technicians because, if you – Steve Kraske, want to seduce the queen, they have to program the queen to respond to your seduction. And you have to fight the Black Knight, and they're going to program the Black Knight to be weak on the left so you can... I mean, it's totally interesting hearing all these technicians kind of... So you get all this other stuff happening. But the performances are fun, and at the end, we have essentially a relentless chase of Richard Benjamin fleeing through a park that's nearly deserted, filled with corpses. All these guests who've been butchered being chased by the kind of cantering gunslinger who's got his hands on his belt and he's looking just like you'd expect him to, but he's remorselessly hunting him down with infrared vision and robotic hearing and he has to. We have a guest who is now really does have to fight for his life and think for himself and get outside the box and out of his comfort level it's really an entertaining movie.
Let's hear some of it. What's the clip we have?
What we have here is we have Brolin and his buddy. We have John and Peter in the saloon, and he's trying to convince – Brolin has already been before, and he knows how it works. And his buddy, Richard Benjamin, is not quite getting into the spirit of things as they have whiskey in the saloon.
From Westworld.
What'll it be?
Whiskey.
What about you?
Vodka martini on the rocks with a twist of lemon. Very dry, please.
Just give him whiskey. He's new in town.
You gotta get into the feel of the thing.
I feel silly.
Why? Looks like a joke.
Well, it's not a joke. It's an amusement park. The best amusement park in the world. All you have to do is have fun.
Some pretty rough-looking customers here. How many of them are,
Guests like us? Who knows? That's the beauty of this place. It doesn't matter. It may look rough, but it's still just a resort.
To get hurt here, just enjoy yourself.
That's from Westworld. That's Jason Hecht's pick for one of his favorite films from 1973. We're surveying the films of 1973, and our final film today is The Exorcist. And by all means, if our listeners can recall when they first saw that film and how you all reacted to it, give us a shout, 816-235-2888. You can also email us UpToDate at kcur.org or tweet us at kcurUpToDate. Mitch Bryan, tell us about The Exorcist, the blockbuster horror film about a 12-year-old girl possessed by none other than the devil.
Well, as I said before, I really do think it's one of the 10 great American films.
That's amazing.
I think that it's extraordinarily convincing even today. The filmmaking is exceptional. The performances are so naturalistic and real. Friedkin went out of his way to try and make it the most realistic film he possibly could. He hired real priests to play priests in two cases. You have Jason Miller, who at the time was not a big star, who was a playwright, who was an unconventional choice, and he's absolutely brilliant because you believe every word he says. You believe that haunted quality behind his eyes, that this is actually a guy who has a priest who has lost his faith. And that's really what the whole movie is about. William Peter Blatty, who wrote the novel on which the film is based, was a comedy writer in Hollywood, and his career was kind of in a low point, and so he decided he would write a novel that would demonstrate another set of storytelling muscles. And he wrote this story based on a real exorcism that had happened in Maryland. And he went to one of his Jesuit mentors and asked him to help him with the process. And the response was from this priest was that, yeah, I mean, if you want to make a movie that's not some tongue-in-cheek thing like Rosemary's Baby was a few years ago, if you want to do something that's really about the mystery of faith and the complexities of evil, then I'll be happy to help you. And the film proceeds with this very sober, concerned, mystical attitude. And it works. And there are so many things about The Exorcist that we forget, I think. When you think about it, it's those moments that, you know, everybody talked about, spewing vomit and head spinning and all that other stuff. But, you know, there's a 10-minute prologue that takes place in Iraq where the picture starts that totally grounds the movie, and it's done with this documentary style, and there's no real underscoring, and you just believe it, and you see the old priest, you know, and coming across remnants of evil in these ruins in Iraq. And the scenes with the doctors consulting with Ellen Burstyn's character about what may or may not be wrong with Reagan. The meticulous and graphic Spinal Tap scene where you're putting this poor kid through these diagnostic horrors, all of which are as horrible as the exorcism itself. By the time you get to that exorcism, which is a full 100 minutes before it ever starts, so it only lasts the last 20 minutes of the movie. You are so primed and ready for it, and scared, and have been so knocked about by the way that the film goes from loud, explosive moments to dead silent
you know, contrapuntal scenes that you just believe it. And I watched it again last night. And it is one of those movies where the saddest thing about The Exorcist is that now they run it on TV on places where there's TV commercials and it's edited. And you never get that sense of beginning to end the way that occasionally when I'll teach a class and we'll decide to show it, you lock everybody in a dark room for 2 hours. And it's a totally different experience. Mm-hmm.
What's the clip we have here?
So the clip here is the initial meeting between Father Karras and the possessed Reagan.
Hello, Reagan. I'm a friend of your mother's. I'd like to help you.
You might loosen the straps, son.
I'm afraid you might hurt yourself, Reagan.
I'm not Reagan.
I see. Well, then, let's introduce ourselves. I'm Damien Karras.
And I'm the devil. Now kindly undo these straps.
If you're the devil, why not make the straps disappear?
That's much too vulgar a display of power, Karras.
Where's Reagan?
In here with us.
Show me Reagan and I'll loosen one of the straps.
Can you help an old altar boy, Father?
Your mother's in here with us, Karras. Would you like to leave a message? I see that she gets it.
That's from The Exorcist. Brad from Prairie Village, where were you when you first saw? How did you react to the film, Brad?
Well, actually, it was a friend of mine. He'd been imbibing a little bit, and he went to see The Exorcist, and they got into the heavy special effects scary portion, and it hit him wrong. And he started laughing so hard, he was sliding out of his seat, and everybody around him just got up and left the theater.
It's a good memory, Brad. Thanks for calling in. I want to thank our DVD gurus, Mitch Bryan and Jason Heck, for coming in. You can find a list of all the films we reviewed today and all the previous shows at kcur.org. And this is from
Live and Let Die.
Live and Let Die. Okay. Monday on the show, Dr. Wes Crenshaw joins us with a panel of college-bound teens to discuss how technology is shaping the lives of young people. We had help this week from KCUR's Kim Noble, Danny Alexander, Beth Lipoff, Caitlin Brennan, and Sangeeta Shastri. Our senior producer is Steven Steigman. Have a great weekend, everybody. I'm Steve Kraske of the Kansas City Star, and you are up to date.